In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Dennis Tech, songwriter, guitarist, and founding member of the seminal Australian punk rock band Radio Birdman. He's also had a host of projects since, including collaborations with the likes of the Stooges' James Williamson and the Rational's Scott Morgan, and this year he's also released his latest solo album, Long Before Day. We'll kick things off, though, with some of a Radio Birdman track. Here's some of Murder City Nights off the debut album Radios Up Here, and afterwards I'll be back on the line with Dennis Tech on your coolest conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and dear listener, it's time for our coolest conversations. My special guest is musician and songwriter Dennis Tech. Here in the Underground Garage, we're familiar mainly with his work with the Australian band Radio Birdman, but his numerous other projects include collaborations with Detroit artists like Scott Morgan and James Williamson, and this year also saw the release of his solo album, Long Before Day. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty great too, because I'm extra thrilled to be speaking with you, man, because you, sir, are one very interesting cat.
Well, it's good to be able to do this, because as you know, I have never had a coolest song of the week. And so I managed to get in somehow with a waiver on that one.
Well, you've done lots of cool things, though, you know, that trumps any particular song. And of course, there's always the next tune that comes out down the pike, too.
That's right.
So I mentioned, you know, your work with Radio Birdman, an Australian band, and I wonder how many folks here stateside are even aware that you're not Australian, that you are American. Are you from Ann Arbor, Michigan, originally?
Yeah, that's right. I born and raised in Ann Arbor. And, you know, my dad worked at the university there, and I was there up through high school and a couple of years at the University of Michigan, and then I went to Australia.
Wow. So I know that the late 60s Detroit kind of music scene was very influential on you, but you would have been like 11 when the Beatles played Ed Sullivan in February of 64. And so often when I'm talking to people, you know, that were in their teens or preteens or even a little bit younger, and if they saw that is like some, you know, music epiphany thing they talk about. That's sort of what launched their music aspirations. Did you happen to see that? Did that play into your music world at all, seeing the Beatles and Ed Sullivan?
Absolutely. That was life-changing for me, like for many other people, and for the whole culture that we live in. It changed everything. It was like a big bang sort of thing. But I was already into music then. I was, you know, even at 11 years old, I was listening to surf music, and the Beach Boys had some hits, and the Ventures, And of course, you know, living where I live, Motown had a very special and intense gravity in that area. So I was listening to that stuff too, Motown records. And, but then when the Beatles came along, it was on the Ed Sullivan Show. I watched it that night. And then the next day in school, I think I was in the fifth grade, the teachers at our school took lessons off for that whole day and said, okay, kids, we're just going to talk about what happened last night and what we saw. Even the teachers at my school realized how profound it was at that time.
Wow. So it has this profound effect on you. You're already listening to music. Were you actually playing music at that point?
Yeah, I not really. I think I started taking guitar lessons at age 12, like, so right after that.
Was there much music in the home growing up, like your parents, or did you have any siblings that were listening to things?
Or was it
discovering stuff yourself on the radio?
Mostly the radio, the little blue transistor radio, you know, that you take to bed with you and your parents think you're sleeping, but you've got that little radio there and you're listening to it until the early hours of the morning. That's what I was doing. My mom was a piano player and her mother was also, and pretty good too, pretty good ragtime player. And we had records in the house, you know, but it was mostly that transistor radio for me.
Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I got two brothers, but they're quite a bit younger than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was your job to leave your record collection for them to listen to.
That's right.
So you start taking guitar lessons when you're 12?
Yeah, I took guitar lessons from this guy in Ann Arbor named Dan Earlywine, who was he was in a band called the Prime Movers. He was the guitar player and Iggy was the drummer. And in Ann Arbor, they were sort of like a progressive jazz blues ensemble. And he gave guitar lessons at the guitar store, Herb David Guitar Studio. And so I took from him at first and then only for a few months. And then I went off on my own and self-taught after that.
Wow. What was your first guitar? First electric guitar?
First electric guitar was a Harmony Bobcat.
And what did you play through?
I had this little Gibson amp that had a 10 inch speaker, you know, just a little Gibson practice amp.
And so that first guitar, first amp, did your parents gift you those things or?
Yes, they did. Yeah. They were really, really good about it. You know, they knew I wanted a guitar so bad. And, you know, my dad went up to that guitar store, which was pretty bohemian, you know, kind of a beatnik hangout at that time. This is before hippies. But it was pretty, pretty funky up there on the third floor of an old building in Ann Arbor. And, you know, I give my dad full credit. He went up there way out of his comfort zone, you know, to get me a guitar for my birthday.
Oh, wow. So you go on later and you do go to medical school and things like this, but overall, were your parents pretty supportive of your music endeavors?
They're pretty lukewarm about it. You know, I think they would have preferred to see me just focus, you know, on the one thing, but on academics, but you know, they understood that that's what I wanted to do. And that, you know, that music for me preceded everything else. And it still takes priority now, you know, it's in the DNA and that's what I do.
So your family takes, or at least I've read this, that your family took a vacation to Australia like in 1967. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a sabbatical year for my dad. He, you know, he'd been at the university for a while as a professor. And when you get to a certain level of seniority, they let you do a year, take a year off and go do whatever you want for a year. And so my father was really big into tennis. And in Australia, you know, Australia in the 60s, it was a big tennis country. And, you know, you had Rod Laver and Ken Rosewall and all these guys. And my dad wanted to play tennis at White City. So he took his sabbatical year in Sydney, and we went there for a year.
Wow. So, and that seeing the country really captured your imagination so much you wanted to go back. What was going on in Australia? What sort of vistas opened up in your mind that captured your soul, wanted to bring you back down under?
I love the ocean. You know, I got into the surf and the surf stuff. And at that time, Australia also had a very vibrant and exciting rock and roll scene. You know, there was a lot of good bands there in 1967. And I was into that too. In Australia, they had a rule where they had to have a certain percentage of local content on the radio. So I heard all this music that I had not been exposed to before and was really excited about that. So the other advantage about Australia is 12,000 miles from Ann Arbor. You know, Ann Arbor's great. I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I could have, you know, growing up there. You don't see it. You think everywhere's like that. But I couldn't wait to get away and start my own life. And that was as far away as I could go.
So you go down there in 67. So how old were you when you went to Australia for the sabbatical year?
14, I guess.
14. So you've been playing guitar for a couple of years. When you were in high school, did you form any bands? Did you play any music with any kids in Australia? I mean, when you were in Australia, were you even in school for that year?
Yeah, I went to school for that year.
Okay.
But yeah, in school, me and my friends formed bands, and you know, these are actual garage bands. I mean, this is garage music, except in Michigan in the winter, it's basement music because it's too cold to go out in the garage.
Right.
And you know, the first group I put together was with this guy named Roger Miller, who was a guitar player that later went on to a band called Mission of Burma. He moved to Boston.
Oh, wow. Okay.
After high school. And so me and Roger, you know, we were 13 in a band and, but you know, never played out or anything, just played in the basement. And in high school, I was in a band called Susie and the Pimps for a short time. I think I got kicked out because I was too assertive. I didn't want to go with the program. And
well, what was the program that you didn't go with? Did you not want to wear flashy pimp clothes or what was going on?
Yeah, I'd seen the Rolling Stones in 1969. And that was another life-changing epiphany type event for me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do more of that kind of stuff, you know, Stones, Who, Kinks. That was the direction I wanted to go in. And they were doing like a lot of novelty music.
What qualifies as novelty music?
They did a 15-minute version of Love is Strange.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well.
They had electric clarinet. You know, it was
okay.
You know, sort of think an adolescent version of the Bonzo Dog Band.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came home from school, and I see the band van driving away down the road, and my amp and stuff are sitting in my driveway. That was how they let me know I was out of the band.
Wow! Wow! So you mentioned, I guess, going a couple of years to college there. Where was it? In Ann Arbor, did you go to college?
Yeah, three semesters. Yeah.
Three semesters. And then the thing about going back to Australia, you go to medical school there. Did you actually finish your undergraduate degree in Australia?
It's different there. They have, okay. It's medicine is 6 years. At that time, it was 6 years starting with undergrad. You just go straight through. They didn't have an undergrad degree and then a medical degree. It was one combined into one thing. So when I got there, I went into the second year of it.
So when did you go to
Australia? I got credit for that first year. I left America in 71. And I kind of took the long way. I went to London first and then Europe, and I ended up in Australia in 72.
So when you went there planning, you were planning to go to school there.
Yeah. I always figured I'd go to school. I never thought I could actually make a living in music. I expected I would always need another source of income. And also I had the idea that, you know, this was something that would be good for the community. You know, whatever community I found myself in, I'd be able to contribute to it if I knew it, you know, if I knew that stuff.
So you go back to Australia and you enroll in school. I know this, what I've read anyway, the first band you formed there was TV Jones. Were you still pursuing your degree when that band started?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was the first we initially called it the Screaming White Hot Razor Blades. And
that's a pretty great name.
Yeah, that was in 72 and a few lineup changes, and it ended up being TV Jones, and which stands for Tech, Vanderwerf, and Jones. This is the three names of guys that were in the band. And that went for a couple of years, actually.
So that's like 72 to 74, maybe?
Yeah.
All right. So Radio Birdman starts up in about 74. Were there any holdovers from TV Jones when you formed Radio Birdman?
Just Pip, the keyboard player, had been in TV Jones briefly, and they kicked him out because I had brought him into the band, and the other guys didn't want him in the band because he didn't play straight time.
Oh,
Pip has a very flexible and that notion of time, which is great, I think, but didn't work for those guys. And so he was in for a very short time, maybe one or two gigs. But as soon as then, of course, I was the next guy that got kicked out of that band and formed Radio Birdman with Rob Younger, my friend Rob. And the first guy we called was Pip.
Excellent. Well, so when you guys are forming Radio Birdman, I mean, that's couple of years before anything is being labeled punk rock,
right?
What did you guys consider yourselves to be? Just a rock band or what?
Yeah, rock and roll. You know, we thought we were going to play old school rock and roll, you know, like back to basics, just raw, you know, like back in the garage. We didn't see it as groundbreaking, but one of the things that I observed in Ann Arbor when I was growing up as a teenager was the energy that the bands had far exceeded the energy level that bands were putting out in the early 70s. You know, like if you went to an MC5 concert, there's some energy going on there. And, you know, and so I said, well, you know, I may not be a very good guitar player, but I can put out some energy. And so that was sort of the way we can carve our own niche here by being a high energy band.
Well, tell me some more about Rob Younger, because you guys were already friends at that point when you began the band. How did you guys meet?
He was in a band with one of my housemates in, sharing a student house. And Rob and Ron had a band. And Ron brought him over. And of course, first thing you do when you come over to somebody's house is look at what records they have. And Rob starts flipping through my record collection and he's like, oh my God. He has kind of a very deep knowledge of American Rock and Roll. He had a very good record collection himself, and so we started talking about music that very few other people in Australia knew about, but he knew about it and became friends right away. And so we spent many long all-nighters listening to records and talking about music.
As it should be. Now, did you haul your record collection to Australia, or did you have to build one when you were there?
I had to build one when I was there.
Oh, man. Money well spent, though. You know, with proper care and handling, it's music to last a lifetime.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing I was wondering about is, so as the, you know, other sort of, lack of a better term, punk band startup, the Saints or whoever, were you guys connected with any of these other scenes that are going on, or was everything very disconnected?
Totally disconnected. There, you know, in Sydney, we were a Sydney band, and
the Saints were from Brisbane, I think, maybe.
Saints were from Brisbane, and and the bands like AC/DC were just getting started, and they had the suburbs. You know, they had the pubs out in the suburbs, and we had the inner city. You know, we stayed in the inner city pretty much, and didn't go out much from there. And there wasn't anybody around that was doing anything like what we were doing, and we didn't know about the Saints until they came out with their single. Mm-hmm. And we thought, this is great. You know, here's some guys that we can get behind and relate to. And then then they moved to Sydney shortly after that, and we did some gigs with them and collaborated on a few things on a business level, you know, or a, you know, a performance level, but not, you know, we didn't actually go into the studio with them or anything, but we loaned them our rehearsal space and got them some gigs. By that time, we were running our own club.
Well, so, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. The Funhouse, is that what you were calling it?
Yeah. Yeah, it started out as the Oxford Tavern. And, you know, the first couple of years, we couldn't get a gig anywhere. We were getting tossed out of places. You know, you'd play two songs and they pull the power on you, and the bouncers will throw you out. And very quickly, we ran out of places to play in Sydney. So we started putting our own shows on. You know, we'd rent a church hall or rent somebody's garage, and a few people would show up, and friends of ours would show up, and we kept playing that way. And then it's a long story, but we ended up getting this residency at the Oxford Tavern by pure luck, because the venue manager thought that Lou Reed was going to come and see us play there.
So he kept having you play until Lou would show up?
Well, it was just the one night, you know. I met Lou, and when Lou came to Sydney, and we were talking, and he said, I'd really like to see your band play. And of course, we didn't have any gigs. So Lou's personal assistant took my information, and I didn't think anything would happen. And then she got a hold of me, and she said, Lou wants to see you guys play. Where are you playing? And I said, let me get back to you. And so we went to the Oxford, where Rob's old band, the Rats, had played before. So we knew the guy, yeah. Bill. And we told Bill, if he let us play there that Friday night, Lou Reed would come. And of course, word gets out, and like 200 people show up at this little place, thinking that Lou Reed is going to come.
Yeah.
And so we show up, we play. Lou Reed, of course, doesn't come. And but we had a great night, you know, with the band played good, and people bought a lot of beer. And so Bill said, you boys did okay. So just to show you my heart's in the right place, here's $10. Gave us a $10 bill for the whole band. And he said, but just be sure you pick up all these beer cans before you go. And then he had us back after that because he had had such a good night. So that's how we kind of got a foot in the door and got started again after being banned from everywhere else.
Well, wait a minute. Did I hear this right? So 200 people show up. You have to pick up beer cans afterwards. So obviously a lot of beer is being drunk, and he whips out a crisp Australian $10 bill and says, "Here you go, fellas. Great work."
Exactly.
Well,
so that got us in there as a, we became the resident band at that place and started building a following. And it was kind of a cultish thing because, you know, it wasn't mainstream and people thought it was kind of hip and cool to know about it. And finally the pub changed hands and the Oxford Tavern was in. And when the pub changed hands, the new owner didn't want to know anything about music. And our manager at the time, George, went up to him and he says, "Give us the music. We'll take over the venue and we'll book all the bands and do all that. You don't have to do a thing and you can sell all the beer." And the guy goes, "Okay." So we put a new sign up, called it the Fun House, and we played there a lot, and we had other bands come in and play a lot too, the bands that we thought were worthy of, you know, getting a chance.
And so when you were continuing it as a Fun House, you were able to make more than just 10 Australian dollars a night.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 We didn't make a lot of money there, but we made enough to pay for posters to be put up and pay the girl that took the dollar at the door and, you know, things like that.
So this whole idea of, you know, how difficult it was for you guys to get gigs and play initially, that's also kind of the story with you just being able to put music out, isn't it? I mean, it was very difficult for you guys to get your records out.
Well, yeah, it was totally independent all the way. You know, I think our first, our EP and then our first album, that was the first independent album in Australia to ever be done there. I mean, it was the studio created a label just for that. And
Trafalgar, was that it? Studios?
Trafalgar, yeah. The studio was called Trafalgar because it was in Trafalgar Street. And and so they created Trafalgar Records just for that one album to put it out. And it was completely independent of the music industry. We sold that out of the back of, you know, distributed out of the back of somebody's station wagon and took it around the stores and stuff and did a mail order.
And then, I mean, you guys, the record does come out. I know here, it's like, I guess in the US, it comes out on Sire like a year later, like in 78. And then at some point you guys wind up relocating to the UK and then everything kind of falls apart.
Right. Yeah. Seymour Stein came to Australia to see the Saints, and because he'd heard about them, and somebody dragged him to see one of our gigs and he loved it. And so he wanted to license our album and sign us as well. And I don't know if you know Seymour Stein, but he has a pure rock and roll heart, that guy. He doesn't care if something is going to make money or not. He just loves rock and roll. He started out as the kid that went for the coffee at Redbird Records in New York, you know, and built Sire Records. And of course, when the punk wave hit, he was signing everything. And everything that he thought was cool. And there were a couple of bands on Sire that were sort of progressive rock bands, like I think it was Renaissance and Focus, and they were paying the bills for this 20 other like punk bands that Seymour had signed around the world. And it just overextended itself and then collapsed, like you say. When we were over in the UK, it he just ran out of knots, and fell out of the sky. And so he kept the Ramones, I guess, and Talking Heads and a couple of others, and everybody else got dropped from the label.
So that's, you know, like
us and the Rosillos and the Saints and the Dead Boys and and the Flaming Groovies and everybody else.
That part, that ends, that kind of ends the first period of the band then, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah. We'd done this long tour over there in the UK and a few gigs in Europe. And by the end of that, we had no label, no money. Some of us not enough to even get back to Australia, and sort of out on the street, you know, and also we'd had enough of each other too.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you get to a point where, you know, whose fart that is, they don't have to say it.
Yep.
Yeah. So the band falls apart in 78, and then somehow you wind up back in the States and you're like a flight surgeon. What in the world was going on here? I mean, I think you did some other things in Australia first, and then you moved back to the States. I mean, at some point you must have finished your medical degree as well.
Yeah, so, yeah, I did. I finished that and did an internship. And so I, you know, by then I'm a qualified doc, and had put another band together in Australia with three of the ex-Birdman guys. It was called The Visitors. And then eventually went back to America and did some more residency training in Detroit. I went back to Detroit for a year. And then I had this, you know, I've always wanted to fly airplanes, and especially jets. And I had the opportunity, I found out about this flight surgeon program in the Navy, where they, you know, you agree to be a doctor for a squadron and they put you in flight school.
How cool is that? All right.
And so I signed up for that and ended up, you know, being a flight surgeon.
So was your brother a pilot?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was in the Air Force, and he was in pilot training when I decided to do that. And I actually went down to Del Rio, Texas to visit him at the training base where he was. And I thought it was really cool what he was doing. And I thought if Kurt can do it, I can do it. And, that's how it all worked out. And it, actually my brother became one of the leading F-16 pilots in the Air Force. And in fact, he's the second highest in the number of hours in the F-16. He had a full career flying those jets.
Well, I've got to bring this up because I just wondered if this is really true, because this is something that pops up quite often, and it has to do with you, flying, that your call name was Iceman, and that the producers from Top Gun heard that and decided to use it for the film. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I'm the original Iceman. That's true. That is true. And it is also true that the film company sent a research team out to our squadron when they were working up for, you know, doing the workup to make that move, that Top Gun movie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're walking around the squadron space in the ready room, out at the airplanes, and they're writing notes, you know, on a clipboard and taking pictures, taking photos. And then they go away after a couple of weeks. And then a year later, the movie comes out and there's Iceman in it. Well, you know, that certainly could have already been in the script way before. I have no idea, but it was coincidental that they were there, and that was my call sign and on my patch and on my helmet, and they came up with that name. But, you know, who knows?
So at this
time, it's a good story. It's a good story anyway.
It's a good story. We're going to say it's true. It's all true.
Okay.
So were you based in where? Montana for this, or
no? I was was actually based in Kay Bay in on Oahu, so island right over there, 175 miles from here. And it's a Marine base, and I was attached to Marine Phantom Squadron there.
Wow.
And from there, we went to the Western Pacific and the Gulf and, you know, Japan and Okinawa and places like that.
So how long were you in the service as a flight surgeon?
I was a flight surgeon for 5 years.
5 years. That's what you, that was a commitment you had to make, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I stayed on in the Navy and for almost 10 years total, including that flight surgeon time, because I went back and did some residency training in the Navy to become an ER doc.
Oh, wow.
So the rest of my career in medicine was all emergency room. That's what I specialized in. And I did that. The thing about emergency medicine, Manfred, it's the perfect specialty if you're a musician, because you don't have an office. It's all shift work.
Yeah.
You can schedule your year in advance. You can say, okay, I'm going to take I'm going to take July and August off because I got to go on tour. And in November, I'm in the recording studio, and you can take that time off and come back to it. And you haven't left anything behind. You know, it's casual shift work, and it's perfect for, you know, somebody leading a dual life like I did.
Well, right there, I want to say all you aspiring rock musicians out there in satellite radio listening land, take note. The medical school route, the way to go, work on being an ER doctor, and then, you know, they can help support your music.
Exactly. That's right.
And your parents will be happy to a degree, I suppose. So,
you know, your parents can never be totally happy, but that does help.
Yeah. So Radio Birdman winds up reforming about around 96. And then 10 years later comes the Zeno Beach album.
Yeah.
Is that the timeline right?
Yeah.
So why did the band get back together, and why did it take 10 years to do another album?
Well, everybody had their own musical projects after the band split up.
Yeah.
In 78. And, you know, Chris went and he formed the Hitmen, and Rob formed the Other Side, and then he formed the New Christs, and he's still in the New Christs. They just had a gig last week. And so everybody did their own thing, but we kept in touch. And eventually the hurt feelings and bad, you know, psychology from the previous times had dissipated enough to where we felt like we could get back together again. And
yeah,
we were out, the Ken West offered us a suitcase full of cash to go down and play the Big Day Out in Australia in 96.
And I guess we should clarify, the Big Day Out is like a huge festival there in Australia.
Big rock festival. Yeah. Big rock festival.
How big a suitcase was that?
It was big enough to get everybody's attention. We'd never been actually paid before, so there was anything in a suitcase was good to us. But it was the first time we got paid. And Chris Mazowieck happened to be visiting at my house when the call came to do it. And so I said, what do you think? And he goes, yeah, let's do it. So we called the others and got back together in 96. And then, of course, going along, some of the same problems come back. Yeah. You know, it's like a dysfunctional family.
Right.
You know, they get back together at Christmas time, and it only takes a couple of days for the old wounds to be reopened. Yeah. So eventually Warwick left, and we got Jim Dixon in on bass. And then Ron Keeley left, and we got Rusty Hopkinson in on drums from UMI. And I was tired of just playing the same old songs. You know, it's like they're good songs. There's nothing wrong with a song, but if you're going to be a real band, you have to have fresh material once in a while. So I told the guys that if we want to keep doing this, we have to do a new album. And there's some resistance to that, but I got my way and we did. And it turned out that 06 wasn't the great time to release an album. You know, it was, that was right when streaming was becoming really popular.
Oh, okay.
Nobody was wanting to buy records then. And I don't know if you were involved in that in that time, but it was commercially it was a flop, although I think it was a good album.
Well, yeah, we've played a number of tracks off of it here in the Underground Garage. We're playing the, I don't recall if, you know, you were mentioned coolest songs. I don't recall a coolest song off there, but like the tracks, we played Hungry Cannibals, the title track, Zeno Beach, Die Like April. That's another one that gets played off of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, we played at least there's three I'm thinking off the top top of my head.
It's amazing to me that you could even recite the names of those songs off the top of your head. That's fantastic.
Well, I mean, I'd have to look stuff up, you know, but yeah, I'd try and prepare. So what I also had read that when Zeno Beach came out, that was the first time that you had toured in the U.S. So you've done shows in Australia, did shows overseas in Europe. So when you finally get to play in the U.S., was that like, an I have arrived moment? I mean, here I am finally rocking in the States.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great. You know, I'd done some U.S. tours with my solo band in the interim period, you know, in the 90s. But to be able to bring Radio Birdman to America and play at that level was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So we toured in both 06 and 07. And we went all over the place. It's great.
So I remember reading around that time, Rob Younger wanted to devote more time to the new Christ. And maybe the band wasn't going to be as active. Is the Radio Birdman now just sort of an extended hiatus, or is there stuff still going on?
We were really active right up until pandemic. You know, we were doing, I don't know, 40 or 50 shows a year, and mostly in Europe. And there was no plan to stop doing that until the pandemic hit. And since then, we haven't gotten back together. But, I couldn't even go to Australia for 3 years. I got two kids that live over there, and I couldn't even go over there and see them, and they couldn't get out to come here.
How old are the kids?
Old enough. Let's see. I guess, my daughter was born in 84 and my son was born in 89. So, so the band, it was impossible to do anything during the pandemic time. And now things are opening up again, and we'll just have to see. You know, I have a tour with my solo band, the one that's on Long Before Day, coming up in January and February in Europe. And after that, I'll have to go to Australia and see what's shaking down there.
I mentioned you working with Scott Morgan and James Williamson, but did you also record and work with Wayne Kramer, like back in the 90s?
Yeah, me and Wayne did an album together called Dodge Main.
Okay.
And that was a studio album. And then we toured. It wasn't really a tour. We did a few showcase gigs as Dodge Main and a couple of benefits. And Scott Ashton played on my first solo album, which was called Take It to the Vertical. And I did a tour with Ron Ashton and Dennis Thompson from the MC5 called The New Race, and a high quality live album came out of that. that tour. So I've worked with those guys. Scott Morgan, I've toured with fairly extensively. I've been to Europe with him a couple of times and a couple of American tours.
And when you're touring with him, you guys are playing material off that 2004 album, The Three Assassins.
Yeah. Is that 2004?
Well, that's what Discogs was telling me.
Yeah. Anyway, seems like it was earlier than that, but yeah, when I toured with Scott, we did a combination of his songs and my songs.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like you've had the good fortune of getting to play a lot with a lot of your musical heroes. I mean, the whole late 60s sort of Detroit scene there, you're kind of checking the boxes of these guys who were really influential to you. Working with, working with heroes is overall that's been good, a good experience.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's overall been really good. I can't think of anybody that was disappointing to be with out of people that I would have considered heroes in my youth. They're all good guys.
Any pinching moments? Like, you feel like, I can't believe I'm really doing this. I'm going to pinch myself to see if I'm dreaming or if I'm awake.
Probably the biggest pinching moment was playing with the Stooges at the Ron Ashton Memorial Concert in Ann Arbor in 2011. They had me come up and I play guitar on, we did TVI, Dirt, Real Cool Time, and No Fun. And what's that? And Loose, of course, yes. So I did those songs, and then Williamson came up and did the Raw Power songs, and it was a full house at the Michigan Theater. And oh man, to me, that was Iggy came running up to me. I'm playing a solo.
Uh-huh.
And he just body checks into me, full slam, full force slam. And I was lucky because I saw this coming about a half a second before impact.
Uh-huh.
So I was able to brace a little bit and keep my head down. And he bounced off of me, and I heard it, even with the amount of noise coming off that stage, which was pretty crushing volume, I heard his head hit the stage, just bam. And he laid there for about 30 seconds without moving. And I looked over at Scotty. Scotty just sort of shrugs, keeps playing. He goes, don't worry about it, you know? And of course he gets up, he's fine. But to me, just, being able to be on stage with those guys was fantastic.
We mentioned James Williamson there in 2020, Cleopatra Records released 2-1. How did that project come together?
James had been doing some sessions for Cleopatra. I think he played on the Robert Gordon album. And there was a couple other things. Shangri-La's did they did some of their stuff over again, and he played on that. So he was in touch with them, and they asked him, would you do an album with Dennis? And, and he called me and said, would I do it? And yeah.
And you were mentioning that, he doesn't write lyrics. So when you guys were working together on stuff, were you supplying the lyrics mainly, and him the riffs or the guitar part, the music, or what? How did the songwriting shake out?
It sort of worked in different ways. There were a few songs where I wrote everything, and there were a couple of songs where he had gotten Frank Meyer to write lyrics, and this other guy, Paul Kimball. And But then the rest of it, we collaborated on and wrote together. And when he had a song that needed lyrics, I wrote the lyrics.
So that was comes out in 2020. Did you guys weren't able to play any shows in support of that, were you?
No, it was right on the cusp of the pandemic starting. We had the main recording sessions in December, of 19. We recorded it in San Francisco, up in Sausalito, what place that used to be part of the record plant called Studio D, and then it was did the vocals here in Hawaii in January, and then it was mixed in March. So right when the pandemic was starting, James was mixing the album. So there was absolutely no chance to showcase any of it or, you know, go out and play any gigs.
So one of the tracks off there, I found my list of the tracks I was listening to, Birthday Present. That's a song that you wrote. Is that right?
Yeah. That's one of mine. Yeah.
And that's kind of the first thing I thought was kind of a surfy feel to it. How would you describe the song?
Yeah, I tend to like to put surf elements in a lot of stuff. It's something in my toolbox that I find to be, you know, really useful to make a song sound different or put something new into it. I just reach up into the air and these things come down I'm sure that these songs, if you don't grab them, somebody else will. They're out there.
Yeah.
And it's not something that I sit down and craft. I'll get the idea and then sort of work on it. But yeah, Birthday Present.
Another
really,
go ahead.
Yeah, it definitely has a surf element to it. Yeah. I'm a huge Ventures fan. Shadows too. I love the Shadows too. But yeah, I listen to that stuff all the time still.
Well, very cool. Another track I wanted to put, the opening cut, I think is really cool. That's the Jetpack Nightmare. Is that right? Jetpack Nightmare?
Yeah, Jetpack Nightmare. Yeah, that's Williamson wrote that.
That's a monster. And also another song of yours, The Liar, is really cool.
Oh, thanks.
That was, those are my hits, my faves off there. But I want to take a moment and talk about your latest release is the solo album, right? It came out May this year.
Yeah.
Long Before Day.
Yep.
Yeah. And so a couple of fave tracks off that include Rearview Mirror and Ain't Gonna Stand For That. And regarding the latter, Ain't Gonna Stand For That, at first I thought it was like an instrumental, and then with about, you know, a minute left, the kind of backing vocals kick in. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, is that Keith Strang on the Fleshtones singing on that?
Yeah,
so I looked up the liner notes, and it says he's playing drums on the album. Well, is that true? And who all is on the record?
Yes, it's true. Besides myself, it's Bob Brown on bass, and Anne, my wife Anne, who used to be married to Keith, is on guitar, and Keith himself is on drums. And I didn't know this, and maybe a lot of other people didn't know it either, but Keith's first instrument was the drums.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he used to be a drummer, and he's recently picked up the drums again. He got a kit, and he's been practicing for a couple of years, and he wants to play drums again. So when we were in the planning stages for this album, he put his hand up and he said, let me play drums. And the drummer that I usually work with on my solo projects is Rick Parnell, who's the drummer in Spinal Tap. Rick died, and Rick's gone. So unfortunately, and so we did need a drummer. And I said, Keith, okay, if you can do it, you're in. And sure enough, he's playing great drums.
Yeah.
And of course, we use them for backing vocals too.
Well, right. Well, you know, that his voice, very distinctive, cuts through, man. It's very cool.
Yeah, nobody sings like him.
No. Yeah. One of the tracks on the new album is titled Home, and the lyrics, you know, describe guy, protagonist, going on and on, following the horizon, ostensibly trying to get home.
Right.
You're a guy that's lived a lot of different places. I mean, you're in Hawaii now. Are you home yet? Where's home?
Well, we used to say home is where the helmet bag is. And I guess you could say home is where the guitar case is. You know, home is wherever I am with my family. I don't feel like any one place is, you know, it's not place specific.
Right. But so there in, so for instance, in Hawaii now, you have a distinct feeling of an at ease where you're at with and Ann. And
yeah, we're very comfortable here. And, you know, we took over this place from my mom when she passed away a few years ago. And it's just such a great place.
Well, this place, is it? I've read or been told, in fact, you mentioned Frank Myers, and we have a mutual friend, Frank and I. Well, I know Frank, but I know his friend Bruce Duff better. And Bruce told me that he had bought coffee from you and that you have a coffee plantation in Hawaii. So is that true? Is that where you're at, on a coffee plantation?
Yeah. This place is a small farm, and where we live. And my mother was doing macadamia nuts, and she had that planted. And she was doing she had a herb garden, and she was selling fresh herbs to restaurants. And we're not doing the herbs anymore, but we still have all those mac nut trees. And and then we planted, when Ann and I first started coming here, we planted coffee trees because there was some area here that wasn't being used and be perfect for Kona coffee. And so, yeah, we're grow, process, and roast and sell coffee on the internet.
So how will we look up Dennis Tech coffee on the internet? Let's just type that up, huh? Type that in the Google thing.
Yeah, the coffee goes under the name Tekona, T-E-K-O-N-A. So it's tekonacoffee.com.
Well, another tune on the album, this what is it? Ballad of Chief Joseph, invokes the spirit of the Native American leader. What inspired you to write about the good chief?
I lived in Montana for several years, and was closely associated with the Crows in Montana. I actually did a lot of work for and with the tribe, both in medicine and in music, and so very interested in Native American culture and Native American history. And one of my favorite places is Sunlight Basin, which is just over the border into Wyoming. And there's a pass there. It's actually called Dead Indian Pass. That's where Chief Joseph led his people to get through those mountains when they were being chased by the army. And I did a lot of reading about it. And it was just a fascinating and, to me, moving story of what Chief Joseph did. And, you know, you're looking for a theme to write a song about.
Yeah.
I figured, you know, Bob Dylan can write songs about historical events. I can, too.
Where can folks get your new solo album from?
They can get it on our website, is DennisTech.com. That's probably the best place to get it as a CD. The vinyl is pending release in a week or two, and that'll be on Wild Honey Records out of Europe.
Okay.
And I think in America, it will be distributed by Green Noise.
Green Noise. Okay. I'm not familiar with them.
That's a Portland
distributor. Well, another favorite track off the solo album, Long Before Day, is Truck and Roll. And I'd like us to take a listen to that in a moment. Seems like one of the lyric lines, if I'm hearing this right, and, you know, misheard lyrics, that ties back to Radio Birdman even. But the lyric I'm thinking I'm hearing is you saying, "Nothing in my coffee, seriously, XM."
Yeah. Yeah, it does say that. I got nothing in my coffee, but seriously, XM. And, you know, yeah, I do listen to XM all the time. And especially when I'm working out there in the coffee, I've either Underground Garage or David Frick, or sometimes I listen to the Tom Petty channel. But yeah, I was really thinking of, you know, the female DJ in the song. I'm thinking of Palmyra.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that's radio. It's life-giving.
Radio is life-giving and rock and roll, I guess, right? You're singing about rock and roll, Please Set Us Free.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to write that one. You know, it's kind of full of cliches. I understand that, but it's, you know, truck driving, rock and roll, America. Why not?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's great Hank Williams songs. And it's like he's writing, and you know what the next line is going to be intuitively. You know what the next line is going to be. And yet, it never seems like when he's doing it, it's never a cliche. It seems like, no, that's exactly what it should be, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it is, yeah.
So rock and roll, It Set and Kept You Free?
Yep.
Dennis, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I had a great time, and thank you so much for thinking of me to do this.
Absolutely. We're going to give that Truck and Roll a spin now. Here's Dennis Tech off Long Before Day in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Up before the sun and I'm hitting the road by fire. I got a load of fast freight and I'm running it down the line. Hit the button on the dash and I'm cranking it up to 10. Seriously, XM. Black Ice Detour State Patrol. Rain and snow don't bother me no more. Rock and roll, if you please, set me free. I got two full tanks and a thermos full of Joe.
With a bit of Truck and Roll, that was Dennis Tech here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Track is off his latest solo album, Long Before Day. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Dennis for speaking with me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. The long-running UK punk rock band The Buzzcocks have issued their 10th studio album this year. It's called Sonics in the Soul. And founding member Steve Diggle will join me to talk about it and the band's career and history. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.